Morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time for arguments in the rehearing on bank of Ellis versus United States District Court for the Western District of Washington. And Judge Kleinfeld is appearing by telephone. Judge Kleinfeld, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Very good. So the petitioner may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Robert Gombiner, and I represent the petitioner, Marciano Ellis. I would like to take 15 minutes of time and then the remainder of the 30 minutes go to Mr. Westinghouse. When Marciano Ellis appeared for sentencing, pursuant to his plea to second-degree murder, one of two things should have happened. Either the court should have accepted the Rule 11C plea agreement and sentenced Mr. Ellis to the sentence agreed upon by the parties, or the court should have or could have rejected the agreement. And at that point, the court needed to address Mr. Ellis personally and give him one of two options, either the option to persist in the plea and be sentenced absent any plea agreement, or the option of withdrawing the plea, in which case the parties would be returned to their positions prior to the entry of the guilty plea.
What do you mean by he could be sentenced notwithstanding the plea agreement? And he pleaded to what, second degree?
He pleaded to
and
second.
And the judge was rejecting that, so the judge could sentence him as though it were first degree?
No, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I'm saying the judge could sentence him to what he had pleaded guilty to, second degree murder, but absent the plea agreement that called for a specific sentence. In other words, the judge could, at that point, exercise his discretion in sentencing and impose whatever sentence he believed was appropriate for second-degree murder.
What power does a judge have to reject a plea agreement?
The judge has, in a Rule 11E1C situation, basically almost unbounded discretion in rejecting the plea agreement. That's what Rule 11E14 says. Because what rule...
Isn't that what the judge did here?
No, that's not what the judge did here.
But well, when is the judge supposed to make the decision as to whether to accept the plea agreement or not?
Under Rule 11, the judge may either make the decision to accept the plea agreement at the time that the plea is entered, or may exercise discretion to reject the plea agreement after he has reviewed the pre-sentence report.
Wasn't that what the judge did here? He reviewed the pre-sentence report and determined that the plea agreement was unacceptable. And he had earlier indicated, at the time the plea was accepted, that he was retaining the option to do that, that he hadn't accepted anything yet. So is this really a question of form over substance that you're bringing to us?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. This is a question of the basic difference between the judge's power to sentence and the prosecutor's power to charge.
So what you're telling us really is that the judges have no control. Once the prosecutor and the defendant enter into an agreement like this, the judge is out of the picture and can't reject the agreement.
No, Your Honor, I am not saying that at all.
But you are saying that largely, at least with respect to the charge bargain part of it. I mean, it might be helpful in this case if we just made believe it was an A agreement instead of a C agreement and left the agreement on the sentence out of it, because I understand what you're saying, that everybody understands that there was no attempt to cram down the sentence. So it's easier to look at it as if the sentence wasn't there at all. And I think that verbally you'll do better that way in terms of what we're really about here.
All right. I understand that that point. But it remains the case that the prosecutor is the one who, under our system of justice, gets to decide what is the appropriate charge.
And in this saying at the outset that Judge Tanner could have rejected the plea agreement right up front. Isn't that correct?
The plea agreement.
Right. So he rejects the plea agreement, and therefore, by rejecting the plea agreement, what? Does he he may not know in the Amidon case, for example, in the D.C. Circuit, you had a very controversial case where the judge probably knew all about the controversial circumstances and may have had some reaction to a lesser degree. But in this case, how is Judge Tanner supposed to know whether or not he should reject this agreement if he thought that the second degree was improper? Are you saying he has no discretion over that?
He doesn't have any discretion absent a fraud upon the court or some extraordinary circumstance of that nature to tell the prosecutor that the case must be tried as a first-degree murder case. The prosecutor is, under our system, the only person who decides whether or not the case should be prosecuted as a first-degree murder case or a second-degree murder case.
Well, were we wrong and fine when we said Congress wanted sentencing judges to review charge reduction plea agreements to ensure that such agreements do not result in undue leniency or unwarranted sentencing disparity? The guidance was to assure that judges can examine plea agreements to make certain that prosecutors have not used the plea bargaining to undermine the sentencing guidelines. Were we wrong there?
You weren't wrong, but that fine doesn't stand for the proposition that once a judge finds a plea agreement to be inappropriate, that what happens is that the plea itself is vacated. In fact, in fine, what happened was there were 14 counts in an indictment. The prosecutor dismissed 12 of them. The parties proceeded to sentencing on the remaining two counts. And nothing in fine says that when the judge found that the plea agreement was, in his opinion, inappropriate, that the remedy was to vacate the pleas to the two remaining counts. In fact, what happened in fine was the defendant was sentenced on the remaining two counts, but the judge considered information from the dismissal.
Well, can a judge say, I'm going to accept this plea, but I'm going to do so conditionally on my review of the agreement in connection with the pre-sentencing report? And it very well may be that after I look at that, I'm going to come back and undo this whole agreement, vacate the plea. You're telling us a judge cannot do that.
I am telling you that, I think this is completely consistent with this court's precedent.
You're saying a judge cannot do that,
right? A judge cannot, if by vacating the plea you mean that the judge is in effect telling the prosecutor, you can't bring this charge of second-degree murder. The only thing I am going to accept is a charge of first-degree murder. At that point, the judge has intruded into the prosecutor's domain.
So let's go back one step in answering Judge Todd's question, because sort of the undoing the timing business is, as Judge Berger says, somewhat irrelevant in this case. I mean, let's say the fact the judge had not accepted the plea, had said, well, I'll think about it. I want to see the pre-sentence report. I'm not going to accept the plea today. I want to see everything before I accept the plea. And so we're back at the original change of plea hearing. Is it your position that if the prosecutor and the defendant, aided by counsel, step up to the podium and say, this defendant wants to plead guilty to mayhem or to treason or, you know, some charge that is on the books of, in the United States Code, the only thing the district judge can do at that point is to say, I'm going to determine whether the plea is voluntary or not, and assuming a finding of voluntariness, the district judge has no choice but to accept the plea. Is that your position?
No, that would be too extreme a position because the...
Okay, let's make it less extreme. Let's say it is a charge that is clearly factually connected with the matter charged in the indictment. So we're now, he's not now pleading to something completely different, but something that is a charge growing out of the facts which are the subject of the indictment. And the prosecutor, it's not a charge that has been, that's in the indictment, because this is a plea bargain, and they've come up with something else, parties are happy, they step up to the podium and say, Your Honor, we want to have a change of plea. Does the district court have discretion to do anything other than determine voluntariness?
The district court does have one other thing to do. It must be satisfied that there's a factual basis for the plea of guilty.
I'm sorry. So if there's a factual basis for the plea and there's voluntariness, then in your view, the district court's discretion is exhausted at that point, and the district court has a mandamusable duty to accept the plea.
Well, I would put one caveat in it. I think the district court can properly inquire the prosecutor to ensure itself that there is no collusion between the parties, that there is no
collusion. What in the world does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I think under the cases that this court has decided, such as Fernandez, Gonzalez, Garcia.
You mean the prosecutor has been paid off under the table?
Well, I think that that is really what...
That's all that's left, if the prosecutor has been paid off under the table.
Not exclusively, but essentially what we're talking about is it's got to be something under... Because we're essentially talking now about Rule 48.
What do you do with the Sentencing Guidelines Manual 6B1.2A that says, in the case of a plea agreement that includes the dismissal of any charges or an agreement not to pursue potential charges, the court may accept the agreement if the court determines, for reasons stated on the record, that the remaining charges adequately reflect the seriousness of the actual offense behavior and that accepting the agreement will not undermine the statutory purposes of sentencing or the sentencing guidelines? It sounds to me like you would erase that from the books.
No, I wouldn't erase it from the books, but I would read it in conjunction with Rule 6B1.3, which says if a plea agreement pursuant to Rule 11E1A or Rule 11E1C is rejected, the court shall afford the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the defendant's guilty plea. And the way I would read the 6B1.2 is certainly the court can review the plea agreement, and certainly it can decide that it's not going to accept the agreement itself, but it can't tell the prosecutor, look, in my view, we're prosecuting these gun cases too lightly. You've got to add a 924C to any drug charge or something like that. That's not what we're talking about here.
But that's what an A agreement is, right? It's nothing but that. So if he's reviewing an A agreement, that must be what he's reviewing.
The court is certainly reviewing the agreement, but what the court is not allowed to do... To hold otherwise really would, I think, plunge our system into chaos. The court is not allowed to substitute its judgment as to what charges are appropriate.
Well, didn't the prosecutor, is it significant that the prosecutor initially charged first-degree murder? I mean, isn't there a first-degree murder charge that was asserted by the prosecutor?
Certainly there was a first-degree murder charge that was asserted by the prosecutor. The point is, though, that at the time the defendant was entering his plea of guilty, almost 2 years had elapsed, and the prosecutor's understanding of the case had changed. There were serious, serious evidentiary problems.
How do we know that it changed? How do we know the prosecutors just don't uniformly bludgeon somebody into pleading by overcharging, and then you're saying they can overcharge and then handcuff the courts by taking a plea to something else?
Well, we can know that in this case because, as I think the United States Attorney can also address, there were specific... That isn't what occurred here at all. What occurred here was that there were serious problems in the government's case, and the government quite appropriately believed that it was better to get a sure plea to a second-degree murder than take the significant chance of an acquittal altogether on a first-degree murder charge.
Would it be appropriate for a judge to say, look, you know, I understand you've got this plea, but I'm not taking it until I review the agreement? So first, Let's review the agreement, and then I'll see whether I'm going to take the plea. And then he says, I'm not approving this agreement. So where are you?
There is a provision for consent, isn't there, for the defendant to agree to let the judge do that?
There is a provision which was which did not take place here.
He didn't consent in this case.
No, absolutely not.
Counsel, you said a moment ago that he should have given him an opportunity to withdraw the plea.
Yes.
And if the defendant does not wish to withdraw the plea, then what does the court do? Say I'm not accepting the agreement and I'm going to sentence him to life? Can the court do that?
The court does exactly this. The court says that if the court rejects the plea agreement, the court shall, on the record, inform the parties of this fact, advise the defendant personally in open court or on a showing of good cause in camera that the court is not bound by the plea agreement, afford the defendant the opportunity to withdraw the plea, and then this is the answer to your question, and advise the defendant that if the defendant persists in a guilty plea or a plea of nulla contendere, the disposition of the case may be less favorable to the defendant than that contemplated by the plea agreement. The rule couldn't be clearer. The court has to give the defendant a choice. The defendant can persist in the plea, and if the defendant persists in the plea, the court is not bound by the plea agreement.
Counsel, is it clear in this case that Judge Tanner accepted the guilty plea itself?
I believe it's absolutely clear. The panel so found, and the record indicates, he never said he made all the findings necessary for acceptance of a guilty plea. He told the defendant, if you plead guilty today, your rights to a jury trial are gone forever. He found that there was a knowing and voluntary plea. He found there was a factual basis. The only thing that he had to find it was a factual basis, otherwise he couldn't have proceeded.
But Campbell, I'm still not understanding. Could he have sentenced the defendant, if the defendant did not wish to withdraw the plea, he could have sentenced the defendant to life?
He could have. Now, of course, the sentencing guidelines protect the defendant, and that would be an appealable ruling because it would be outside the guidelines. But he retained the discretion to sentence the defendant to life.
Could you just – I'm not quite sure I understand the answer to Judge Berzon's question. Suppose they came in with a second-degree murder indictment, one count second-degree murder, and the judge said, I don't think that's enough punishment for this offense. I want to reject that and insist you come back with a first-degree murder charge. Could the judge refuse to accept the plea?
No. In my opinion, the judge could not refuse to accept the plea absent a showing of
I don't care whether it was corruption or that he didn't understand.
Otherwise,
I just say the judge doesn't like the charge. He thinks it's not serious enough.
The judge is not the one who gets to decide whether the charge is serious or not. That's the way the system works. That's what United States versus Miller says.
All right, one other question is, what is the effect of a judge accepting a superseding information, accepting a plea on the basis of the superseding information? What is the effect of the acceptance of that superseding information upon the existence of the prior indictment?
It acts as essentially a dismissal of the prior charge. It would be double jeopardy for the defendant to be sentenced on second-degree murder and then charged on first-degree murder.
Not sentenced. I didn't say sentenced. I said you accept a plea.
Right.
Based on a superseding indictment, you read the superseding indictment, you say this is what you're being charged with, accept the plea. At that point, what is the status of the superseding, of the original indictment?
Well, the original indictment is essentially since suspended animation, I think, is maybe the... It can be revived if, in fact, the plea to second-degree murder for some reason falls through, but absent that, that the superseding indictment does just what superseding means.
Well, can't fall through. You mean if it's withdrawn? Is it? If a plea has been accepted,
right,
it can't fall through. It can be withdrawn, as I understand.
Right. And once it's withdrawn, then...
Then the indictment is automatically reinstated.
That would be my position.
I think your position would be the same if you had a situation... in this case, we had a district judge who thought that the plea was too soft.
Right.
Let's say it were the other way around. The court looked at an indictment and said, this is a case where the government has way overcharged, and I can tell there is a sort of thin factual basis for the one count for which the defendant pled is, I can tell the only reason he did it is because of the, just couldn't take the risk of going to trial on this overcharged indictment. And I think the defendant would get acquitted. And I really think the defendant ought to go to trial, because this is really a plea that's extracted by overreaching and overcharging on the part of the prosecution. I take it your answer would be exactly the same.
Exactly. What's sus for the goose is sus for the gander. I have way overtaken my time, and I don't want to cut Mr. Westinghouse off. I'd be, of course, happy to
violate the plea if he doesn't get half the time.
I'm sorry?
Does that vitiate the plea if he doesn't get the half time?
That's an excellent question, but it does initiate an informal understanding between Mr. Westinghouse and myself. So,
okay.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Bob Westinghouse, appearing on behalf of the United States of America. The reality of this case is that the government found itself with an indictment for first-degree murder, and an evidentiary problem that created great concern
What was the evidentiary problem?
There were a multitude of evidentiary problems, Your Honor, beginning with the fact that every statement made by the defendant to any friend about this homicide included gross exaggerations and outright lies.
What about the statement where he's on a wire and he says, yeah, that was me, in response to a friend asking about the murder of the cab driver? What's the exaggeration?
It is true.
He said, yeah, that was me.
That was me. But to that same friend, days earlier, he had said he took $2,300 from the victim, and he displayed what purported to be the victim's taxi license. In fact, the victim never had $2,300 in his life. And his license was found pinned to his lapel when he was discovered.
How did you have the killer? You had the wrong guy?
We believe we have the right defendant.
Hearing you say you weren't sure. And so
I'm saying, Your Honor, the difference between a prosecutor being certain and being able to convince a jury
of anything involving identity,
anything with respect to whether this individual, Marciano Ellis, committed this crime, is a far different question. And that's one that the court never explored, even though it was repeatedly stated to the court, there are evidentiary problems. We are here today with the second-degree murder because it is better, in the view of the executive branch, to get something out of this case, to keep this killer off the street for some period of time, than let him walk free.
Counsel, I'm missing something here. It strikes me that if he's a cold-blooded, premeditated murderer, it's better to convict him. And if he's innocent, it's much better that he walk the streets a free man than that you get something on him, such as second degree.
Judge Kleinfeld, the challenge is to distinguish between the conviction of a prosecutor that the individual charged is guilty, on the one hand, and the challenge of convincing a jury of 12 men and women beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty. That's quite a different matter.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question. Assume that there is clear error in this case. Are the other Bauman factors, in particular, present?
I believe they are, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. First, with respect to prejudice, if the court is wrong in its decision rejecting the plea, the result, if there is not an issue of mandamus, is that this defendant will have to stand trial for first-degree murder, an Amadon situation. The end result is the struggle with a trial, the struggle for both the petitioner and the government with a trial that may take many weeks, use the judicial resources in that trial, only to have this court, after going through the struggle and, I would assume, the emotional climax of being found guilty of first-degree murder, come back and say, no, the court was incorrect in its earlier rejection of the plea. There should not have been a first-degree conviction. You may plead guilty to second degree. That is prejudice.
If what Judge Tanner did stands, then a first-degree murder trial is the necessary result, or the government could also decide to just drop all charges, too.
If what Judge Tanner did in this case stands, the choice for the government is to proceed with a first-degree murder indictment or move to dismiss that charge. The United States would have every intent to proceed with a first-degree murder charge because, as I've stated, the executive branch has a conviction that the evidence is sufficient. But again, that's far different.
You could dismiss the first-degree charge and re-indict on the second degree.
Yes, Your Honor, but that would be impractical in this case because if the defendant committed the crime, the evidence is quite clear. It's first-degree murder. There was premeditation.
I see. So your doubts don't go to the difference between first and second.
Our doubts go to whether we can put the defendant in the taxicab. We can put his gun in the taxicab.
You can put the shell casing in his house that was used to kill the driver.
Absolutely. There's no question, Your Honor, that the weapon was, in fact, the defendant's weapon.
Was the girlfriend going to testify she bought it for him?
Absolutely. No doubt about that. But we can also produce, and the government has produced for the defense, the statements of witnesses that will place the weapon in the hands of the defendant's best friend shortly before the crime occurred.
Am I correct?
And again, shortly after the crime was discovered. So we have a problem, Your Honor, in demonstrating that this defendant had the gun in the taxicab and used it.
And your position is that once you go in with a situation like this, the judge's hands are tied. You tie the judge's hands by your assessment of the case.
No, Your Honor. That is not our position. Our position is that the court has some discretion.
What is it?
Discretion is a matter of considerable confusion for all of us because of the myriad of court decisions. It is something akin to whether there is a breach of manifest public interest.
So is it basically the same on a Rule 11, on an A or C agreement as under Rule 48? Is that basically what you're saying?
I believe that that is the best standard, but I don't believe the court has to reach that far today.
Would it have made any practical difference? As a practical matter, I gather the tradition in doing this is that you agree that you're going to later dismiss the original indictment.
Yes, sir.
But I suppose you could have also just gone in and dismissed the indictment under Rule 48, and you could have resuscitated it later if you needed to.
Well, there are two problems with that, Your Honor. The court is correct. That could have been done. But if that was done, we then face the potential that the defendant does not plead guilty to second-degree murder. He comes in and says, no, I don't plead guilty to anything. Then we have to go back.
No, you could have a plea agreement. In other words, if you had the same plea agreement, but instead of agreeing to dismiss it at the end, you agree to dismiss it at the beginning.
Yes. And we dismiss it, and the defendant says, thank you very much, government. I don't choose to plead guilty. Then we are in a position, we've dismissed our indictment.
But you can revive it.
Your Honor, once we have dismissed an indictment, the only way I know to revive it is to go back to a grand jury.
Right.
In this instance, there were weeks of work before this indictment was returned. We put approximately 15 to 20 witnesses before the grand jury. We then are faced with the predicament of having to bring each of those witnesses back, create another set of gents material.
That's not the only way to do it.
Oh, they can read it.
They could read it, Your Honor. That's correct.
It can be summarized for them.
That is also correct.
They don't even have to be there, most of them.
Sometimes.
Right.
That's correct. May I ask you another question?
Can I ask you whether
yes, sir.
There's any reason for us to reach all these issues of what a judge could do if you presented a plea to him that he didn't like. Do we have to go beyond deciding what happens when a judge has accepted a plea? We've been talking a lot about whether the judge could reject it to start with.
The case we have is a judge who has accepted a plea. Should we go beyond that question of whether what you do once you've accepted a plea, what the judge's authority is then? Should we consider more than that in this case?
Your Honor, the Court does not have to consider much more than that. The Court has already decided in U.S. v. Miller that the district judge must, in accepting or rejecting a plea, make a record as to the prosecutor's reasons for the charge bargain and the court's reasons for rejecting. That was not done here.
You don't disagree that if the judge goes back and says, you know, I made a finding of voluntariness, but I thought some more about the evidence and I don't believe it's voluntary, or I might have found a factual basis, and time has passed, it's not on my conscience, I've thought about it, and I now find there's no fact. You don't dispute that this judge could go back and undo the guilty plea by reconsidering the findings that are required to accept the plea.
Over the objection of both parties, is that the question, or just with the consent of the parties?
Sua sponte.
Over their objection.
To any of those, Your Honor, I do not disagree with Judge Kaczynski's proposition. If the court concludes that Rule 11 has not been satisfied because there is neither voluntariness nor a factual basis, then the court has the authority and, in fact, the obligation to go back and say this is not correct. And an example of that, I believe, would be the Patterson decision, which reached the right result, I respectfully submit, for the wrong reason.
Yeah, let me ask you this question. Were you the you were in court when the plea was taken?
Yes, Your Honor.
And were you there when Judge Tanner rejected the plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you were there during this colloquy that ensued between the judge and the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. I participated in all of
those. Is there any reason why you didn't call to Judge Tanner's attention the fact that that he needed to address the defendant and tell the defendant that he did set forth his reasons for rejecting the plea agreement, but any reason you didn't object when he didn't point out to the defendant that the defendant had certain alternatives, that he could withdraw his plea or he could let his plea stand and that he would be sentenced to judge saw fit under the guidelines? I mean, you just sat there while all this was going on.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
What?
I respectfully disagree. I did not just sit there.
What'd you do? I got the transcript here.
I understand, Your Honor, and I've reviewed the transcript carefully. I believe that both the government and the defense were dumbstruck that the court, after having, we believe, accepted the plea on December 8th, more than 4 months later on April 17th, announced that it was not accepting it. And we spent the balance of that proceeding attempting to convince the court that this was, in fact, a plea that should be accepted.
Well,
the court ultimately did not want to hear that, and the court said, we're going to arraign the defendant on the first-degree murder charge.
The court kept telling you to stop acting like the defendant's lawyer. He told you several times that you were supposed to be representing the government and not telling the court that it didn't have the authority to do this.
That's exactly what happened, Your Honor. He did not want to hear anything about the reasons for the plea.
What should the judge have done at that point?
You're not answering my question. I asked you if you pointed out this deficiency to the judge, that he wasn't following the rule.
Your Honor, the deficiency was certainly pointed out.
You didn't tell him, look, you're not following the rule. You're not giving him an opportunity to withdraw his plea or let his plea stand. You didn't point that out to him, did you?
Your Honor, at the time the plea was...
I knew you were dumbfounded, but you didn't.
We were dumbfounded,
yeah,
and the court arraigned the defendant.
We might not even be here.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because...
He could have let his plea stand, right? to let his plea stand. That was it.
Within day.
The transcript of the motion, was there a subsequent motion made? Because I see a statement by you that says, so we're the drive, we're absolutely clear on that, and ask the court, and I respect the court's decision.
Mr. Wardlow, would you please speak up?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm just having.
I'm reading from the transcript of the motion, which I assume came after.
Within days, Your Honor.
All right. So you said, Your Honor, so that we are absolutely clear on the record, I would ask the court, and I respect the court's decision, I would ask the court to inquire of the defendant as to what he would choose to do if, in fact, the court rejected the plea agreement, because I think it's important. And that's when the court started interrupting you and saying, Mr. Westinghouse, I didn't understand that the United States Attorney represents the defendant. And you don't do all of that. So I don't know where you were going, but you were stopped. Well, you also say, yes, Your Honor, I believe the court must inquire of the defendant as to what he wishes to do pursuant to the law. And that's again asking to represent the defendant. I don't know what really you could have done.
Judge Ferguson, in answer to your question, Judge Wardlaw is correct. In answer to your question, at the time of the anticipated sentence, the only thing that we did was try and persuade the court that the plea ought to stand. When the court said, no, I'm not accepting that plea at any time, at any place, under any circumstances, the court said, I'm going to arraign the defendant and set the matter for trial, and he did. I did not say at that moment, but, Your Honor, the court needs to follow 11-4. Days later, the motion was filed.
And the judge, he arraigned him on the first degree. Murder charge, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor.
Yeah,
he
would have plea, guilty or not guilty.
He did do that.
And nobody objected to that either.
Well, Your Honor, in the context of this proceeding in Judge Tanner's court, it was abundantly clear that if we had objected, the marshals might have been.
Am I correct that your position is the same?
I just wanted to hear you say that.
Yeah.
That's
it.
Well, we got there.
Am I correct that your position is the same as the petitioner's, except that you don't ask that this be sent back to another judge?
That's essentially correct. Although,
could you like to have the marshals come haul you away?
Well, it hasn't happened yet, Your Honor, my practice, but it may at some point. Are we close there today?
All right, your time has expired.
Always be sure to bring a toothbrush.
Very well, Justice.
All right, you have used all of your time. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Peter Gonick, and I, along with my colleague, Gene Wilson, represent the respondent, United States District Court for the Western District of Washington in this matter. Mr. Wilson has asked me to convey his regrets that he could not be here today to argue this for the reasons that were expressed in our motion to continue the oral argument. This case is about a trial court properly rejecting a plea agreement that is not in the public interest. The court rules, sentencing guidelines, and opinions of this court and the United States Supreme Court support the panel opinions, reasoning, and conclusions, and that those reasoning and conclusions should be adopted by this panel.
But the judge did more than reject the plea agreement. Nobody disputes that he could reject the agreement. He actually refused the plea.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It is the position of both of the petitioners, the government and the defendant, is that district judges simply do not have discretion to refuse a plea that is both voluntary and factually founded. I mean, the district court determines there's a factual foundation. If the prosecutor and the defense step up to the podium and the defendant is willing to plead guilty, it is their position that the district judge has no discretion but to accept that. And I must say, the rules seem to support that. If the judge has no discretion, then the public interest must not be vested with the court in that. That's why we have prosecutors. They get paid out of the same funds that judges do, and so maybe they are the ones who must determine the public interest.
I agree, Your Honor, that if a judge did not have discretion as to whether or not to accept the guilty plea, then the public interest would not enter into it.
Where in the rule do you find that? Where do you rule do you find that discretion?
Your Honor, I find it under Rule 11. When the plea is pursuant to a plea agreement under Rule 11E1A. And the court rules specifically state that the government and defendants may enter into agreements where the defendant pleads to a lesser degree or that certain and in exchange
I'm
for
sorry,
that.
Where does it say that the district judge can reject the plea? Where does it say? I understand that the district judge can reject the plea agreement, but what language in Rule 11 do you rely on that gives a district judge discretion to say government wants to accept the plea, the defendant is willing to plead, there is a factual basis, clearly voluntary, there is counsel present who has counseled the defendant, but I don't feel like accepting the plea today. Where does that describe, where in Rule 11 or anywhere else is that discretion given to the district court?
Your Honor, I believe it's in Rule 11E1A and E4 and E2 where they talk about, and it's only in the context of when the plea is subject to a plea agreement. In other words, if the defendant and the prosecutor came to the court.
E4, you say, which reads that if the court's not bound by the plea, that he must afford the defendant the opportunity to then withdraw the plea. Now, where does it say that he can vacate the plea on his own?
It does not specifically state that, Your Honor.
But if it says he can do, if he doesn't want to accept the agreement, that he can then has to tell the defendant and allow him to withdraw it. You'd say we should imply into that, or over the defendant's objection, he can vacate it anyway.
Yes, Your Honor. When the
what do you do with the language if the defendant then persists in a guilty plea? What does it mean, persist?
Your Honor, I'd submit that that language would refer to the situation of a multiple-count indictment where the defendant is pleading to one or two counts on agreement that the government will dismiss the other counts. In that instance, if the court rejected the plea agreement under 11E1A, the defendant would be permitted to persist in his guilty plea and the other charges would still remain out there. The government could still try him on those charges. But when we have the context of pleading to a lesser degree charge, of course, the government would not be permitted to do that because of the double jeopardy clause. And I believe that is what this court in the United States versus Cordova-Perez opinion addressed, in that when you have a plea agreement where you're pleading to a lesser degree that necessarily involves a dismissal of the greater charge, the only way to when you reject that plea agreement, it necessarily rejects the plea.
Well, but why isn't the concern of the district court addressable under the sentencing options that are available to a second-degree murder charge? The PSR came in with a recommendation to sentence at the high end of the range. Are you saying that this was such an outrageous case that that was inappropriate and that we should defer to that? And if it was, wasn't there the optimum range, actually, life imprisonment? Why could the court, if it's as outrageous an undercharge, why wouldn't the court be able to address the concerns that way and adjust all the way up to life in prison? It may be subject to appeal as to whether it's right or not, but why should it be at the front end of the case on the charging side of it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that goes to the basic reasoning behind the sentencing guidelines and the restrictions that it does place on a court's discretion. It's
right.
True
that's
that the maximum
get,
penalty.
That's where the court normally addresses overcharging or undercharging or whether the matter reflects the seriousness of the crime. What you're saying is that the judge can accept a plea of guilty to a second degree, then review the PSR and decide that he, without getting consent of the defendant to review it before accepting the plea, he's now accepted the plea. Now the defendant is subject to a judge who has made up his mind based on reviewing the PSR, and he goes back and vacates the plea itself. And you're saying that's all embedded in Rule 11E4?
Yes, Your Honor, as if one considers it in connection with the sentencing guidelines.
What's the point of Rule 32e, then, that says the judge isn't supposed to look at the PSR before deciding whether to accept a plea?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that has to be read.
Or without consent of the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that has to be read in context with the sentencing guidelines, which specifically state that when a court is reviewing an 11E1A plea agreement, that the court should only accept the plea agreement if the remaining charges adequately reflect the seriousness of the offense. And in a situation...
Those two provisions just seem to be going off in opposite directions. And since one is binding on us and the other one isn't, I guess we have to deal with the one that's binding on us, Rule 32 and Rule 11.
Your Honor, I do not believe that the two rules are inconsistent. Because as this Court in United States v. Cordova Perez stated, if the defendant enters a plea pursuant to a plea agreement to a lesser degree offense, that plea is conditional, inherent in that plea agreement. It's conditional.
But that doesn't that run into high, just square?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, no.
Because?
Because the High Court and the Cordova Perez Court were considering entirely different issues, as the panel opinion, I believe, pointed out quite well. In fact, if you look at the Cordova Perez opinion, they spend a great deal of time considering whether the court had accepted the plea and the plea agreement or whether it had just accepted the plea. So even the Cordova Perez Court itself recognized that there is a distinction, that there are two separate events.
Exactly, and that's why here, when the plea was agreed, was accepted or not the, but not the plea agreement, that the plea can be binding without the plea agreement. No.
Well, Your Honor, it's a conditional plea. So it is binding on the defendant with respect to...
What's conditional about the plea? There is a conditional plea section. This isn't that kind of a conditional plea. You have a plea, and then if the court doesn't accept the plea agreement, it can be withdrawn. But it's a plea, isn't it? I mean, it's an unconditional plea. Unqualified plea, he said, I'm guilty. It's a conviction, which he then has the right to withdraw under certain circumstances, or the government can withdraw under certain circumstances, under the agreement.
And we submit,
but
Your Honor...
But there's nothing in the agreement that says, or if the court doesn't like it, he can vacate it.
There's nothing specifically outlined and stated in black and white. No, Your Honor.
Or red or green or pink. It's there's an agreement that says... I'm guilty. I plead. I'm convicted.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if I don't get sentence A, I can withdraw the plea. Or the government can withdraw if it doesn't get sentence A. And so you specify the parties who have a right to set aside the agreement. And you say we should say, and implied in that also, is that if the judge changes his mind, he can do it.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't say it's if the judge changes his mind. I would say that if the judge, pursuant to the sentencing guidelines, reviewed the pre-sentence report and reviewed the plea agreement under 11E1A to dismiss the greater charge and determined in the exercise of the court's discretion that the plea agreement, the remaining charges did not adequately reflect the seriousness of the offense, then he rejected the plea agreement. Now, part of that...
I gather that you would agree that Rule 48 has a different standard than the one you're advocating.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right. Why should these two be different? Why should it matter whether the government comes in at the outset and says, we're going to substitute and we're going to dismiss the earlier indictment and have a superseding information, or it says we're going to have a superseding information and later we're going to dismiss the indictment. Why does that matter in any way that the public interest should care about?
Your Honor, it matters because of the intersection in any charge bargain between the executive decision of charging and the judicial power of sentencing. And I believe this is adequately addressed on point in the commentary to the sentencing guidelines, section 61.2, and I'll...
Well, I know they say this, but I didn't find it convincing when they said it either. I don't understand what difference it makes.
Your Honor, there seems
to be some notion that the government has to take responsibility for doing this, but eventually they are going to take responsibility for doing this. They're going to dismiss it, and if the public doesn't like it, it's going to be visible. So what difference does it make what the order is?
Well, Your Honor, one of the reasons behind that policy may be to prevent the type of overcharging or bludgeoning a defendant into agreeing to the lesser offense that was referred to earlier here.
But they can always revive the indictment. It may be a bother, as he was explaining, but they can revive it. So what difference does it make?
Well, Your Honor, it places greater authority or power with the defendant when the defendant is given a situation where, okay, we've now charged you with murder in the second degree. You're not bound to accept it. You can plead not guilty. You can plead guilty. What do you want to do? And if the government wants to continue to dismiss the first degree.
I'm positing a agreement that says it's still an agreement, but the agreement is the government will dismiss the charge. There will then be a superseding information. The defendant will then plead to it. All right? And we're just reversing the order of things. And you're saying that makes all the difference in terms of what standard that applies.
No, Your Honor. Forgive me if I gave that impression. I do not believe the timing of it has any relation to it. If it's part of the plea agreement, then it doesn't matter when the dismissal occurs. It's only when a dismissal or a plea is presented to the court that is not part of a plea agreement that the Rule 48 betrayal of the public trust or abuse of manifest public interest standard would apply.
Under federal law, once the government has indicted somebody for first-degree murder, can the government come in and dismiss the indictment without the approval of the court? Just we dismiss the indictment, or does it have to be a motion that has to be granted by the court?
There has to be a motion granted by the court, Your Honor. And I would agree with the government and the petitioner that a different standard would apply in that situation where the dismissal
is
standing alone.
What does that mean? If the district court sets the case for trial and the prosecutor doesn't show up,
then you recuse the prosecutor and appoint the attorney general. That's the way they do it in state law.
Yeah, well, that's state. Well, you can't really force the government to present the case it chooses not to present.
No,
the
you
court
cannot.
Can be there all day. You can impanel a jury, but ultimately,
doesn't the prosecutor have a duty not to present the case, whatever the judge thinks, if the prosecutor believes that that's an improper case to present?
Absolutely, but I do not understand the government to...
No, not in this case they didn't.
Yes.
But we were having a sort of interesting theoretical discussion.
I disagree with Judge Reinhart. I think the prosecution has to come to court, but it can say what it wants to the jury when it gets that opportunity.
It could say, I quit the guy.
Absolutely.
I quit the guy. And it can also fail to put in key evidence
so as
to give the jury no choice but to acquit.
And Your Honor,
what do you then say to the separation of powers argument? I mean, we've sort of been talking about the rules and all that.
Yes.
But ultimately, if we were to approve what the standard did here, we would be forcing the government to essentially be making prosecutorial, the court would be making prosecutorial decisions for the government, for the United States, for the Attorney General. Government, for whatever reason, whether it thinks it's improper, doesn't have a case, or whatever reason, thinks it does not want to go forward with the indictment, the counter indictment that the district court thinks the government should go forward with. And isn't that a classic battle of the power of the two branches? And isn't the correct answer clearly that the judiciary, which is there to adjudicate cases presented to it, is not empowered to force the Attorney General, who, after all, is politically responsible, the U.S. Attorney who works for the Attorney General, who works for the President, who is politically responsible, to go forward with a case where the prosecution thinks, for whatever reason, this should not be prosecuted, either because it's a bad prosecution or because it doesn't have the facts, it's going to lose or whatever. Isn't that ultimately the choice of the executive branch?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So wouldn't upholding Judge Tanner in this case put that power, take it away from the prosecutor, and ultimately put it in the hands of the judiciary where it does not belong?
No, Your Honor, it would not, because the prosecutor, even in this case, wouldn't have to go through the perhaps one could call it the charade of having a trial and not presenting evidence. They could simply bring a motion to dismiss under Rule 48, dismiss the first-degree indictment, and charge a second degree. And so we're not talking about the charging decision. But I agree, Your Honor,
this is the hopscotch theory of justice. If they had gone three steps over and two steps to the left, it would have been okay. And then we'd be exactly in the same place where we are now, but that would have been okay. What's the point of that?
The difference
if you're saying, yeah, go ahead.
The difference is, Your Honor, when the charging decision is part of a plea agreement, that the courts have been specifically told, we want you to review these plea agreements. We want you to review.
This is what's really strange. If the prosecutor does it this way, he's going to have a second-degree charge and a conviction. If he does it the other way, he's going to have a second-degree charge and possibly no conviction. And why is the public interest better served that way?
Well, Your Honor, because the executive function of deciding which charges to bring is not implicated when really what the government and the defendant have done here is they've done a plea negotiation because they want to restrict the sentencing discretion of the judge.
Suppose they come back with an A type and they simply say we're going to dismiss the first degree, he's going to plead to the second, open-ended on sentencing. Here we are, Judge Tanner. Which is the same result that could have been achieved under, as I read it, under 11E4. What's the difference?
I agree, Your Honor, that for purposes of analyzing this, it's a good idea to forget about the 11E1C.
All right, so we take that out. But now they come back in with a plea agreement. He's going to plead to second degree, no constraints on sentence.
Yes.
What's the difference?
The difference is that there is a constraint on sentences, and the constraint is the sentencing guidelines.
No. Well, okay, but so what?
But that would be the
same
constraint.
So you're saying at that point, even if they come back with a stipulated plea to second-degree murder with no constraints on the judge's ability to sentence other than the restraints on the guideline, Judge Tanner could reject that?
Yes, Your Honor.
But on the other hand, if they had come in and said we dismiss the first-degree murder charge and we substitute an information and the defendant has agreed to waive indictment, then the judge would have to apply the manifest injustice standard, and the same exact thing could happen.
Yes,
except that the government would be less protected because maybe it wouldn't happen and maybe they wouldn't get their conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is because of this, in a charge bargain, and I believe the reason that all the parties have had some trouble in addressing exactly what discretion a judge has is because of there's a bit of a gray area in a charge bargain. Is it executive or is it judicial? It does trespass on the judicial function of sentencing because it restricts what a court can do.
But so does the dismissal. But so does the dismissal. Because ultimately, in other words, I just don't see the difference. I don't see what difference it makes if they dismiss it and substitute second degree. The exact same consequences for sentencing are there with the additional consequence that there might not be a conviction at all.
I thought you told me they couldn't dismiss it without the court's approval.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there would be a different standard applied, and that standard would be under Rule 48, which is a much higher standard as recognized by the cases cited by the government regarding Rule 48, and those cases specifically state we're not talking about a charge bargain here, we're talking about a straight dismissal. And there is the distinction made because it's not presented to the court as a package. When it's presented to the court as a package.
I still want an explanation about what difference that makes to any interest or under any conceivable theory of the public interest, what difference that makes.
Well, Your Honor, other than the one that I have identified in terms of giving more power to the defendant, where when it's the you avoid somewhat the power of the prosecutor to overcharge and then say if you agree to the lesser charge I'm going to dismiss the greater charge. And when it's presented to the court as a single package like that, the defendant is powerless to do anything to prevent that. If it is done more piecemeal, where the prosecutor is making executive decisions, okay, I'm going to dismiss this. There's no promises made to the defendant. There's no promises made by the defendant. I'm just going to dismiss this, and I'm going to bring a second-degree murder charge. The defendant now has more power and authority to say, well, let's go to trial. Or let's discuss other decisions.
And then the prosecutor can say, okay, we're going to trial on first-degree murder. I'm going back to the grand jury. It's just a bunch of steps, as Judge Kuczynski was saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why that should be a major substantive difference in the standard of review is very hard to explain.
There is substance and process.
Mr. Gonick, I have a question for you. Can a judge, let's put aside that the plea was accepted at the start. Could a judge reject a plea on the grounds that the factual basis here is it's either the more extreme offense or it's nothing? In other words, the lesser included offense is not presented by the facts. Can a judge reject a plea on that basis so that, let's say, the prosecutor wants to compromise, but the only question in the case is identity. It's first-degree murder if you shoot a cab driver in the back of the head. It's not second-degree murder. So can a judge say, looking at the evidence, he's either guilty of first-degree murder or innocent, and I'm not going to accept a plea to the lesser. Is there any authority on that?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor.
Could the judge have said that the guidelines don't adequately reflect the seriousness and upward departure to life imprisonment?
Well, Your Honor, it could. The pre-sentence report noted that it didn't see any reason for departing upward. Obviously, the court's not bound by that. It makes its own determination. But whether or not it could find that it was not adequately reflected and make an upward departure, there's no question that it was an attempt to hamper the judge's sentencing ability. That's the whole reason why charge bargains are made, so that the defendant
is getting some assurance. But that's a consequence of the sentencing guidelines.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Many of us don't like. Some of us like a lot. But they are, the Supreme Court has upheld them. And so the reason judges can't sentence any way they want to, even though they think the defendant is much worse than the prosecutor may think he is, or the prosecutor thinks he can prove, is we've got sentencing guidelines. And that's another appeal. If the district judge wants to depart, there's a authority to do that, but it's limited.
I agree, Your Honor, that it's because of the sentencing guidelines, and whether one likes them or not, the sentencing guidelines themselves have realized that this could be a problem, that prosecutors could be making charge bargains in order to bind the court's hands, basically, and that's why the sentencing guidelines have said, do not accept a plea agreement unless the remaining charges adequately reflect the seriousness of the offense. And that's exactly what we have here. The remaining charges do not adequately reflect the seriousness of the offense. And so the guidelines tell the court that, okay, we recognize we're going to severely hamper your discretionary ability, but we want to make sure, and Congress has stated
that's 6B1.2.
But we don't get there anyway unless we regard this guilty plea, which did happen and was not deferred, as somehow conditional, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I have neglected to state, just because of the nature of the way that the questions have gone, that, of course, we submit that the plea was not, in fact, accepted. And
I'm nearly out of time,
so I won't address that. But
did the judge set a sentencing date?
He did, Your Honor.
Without accepting a plea?
Yes, apparently.
Well, didn't he say the next thing that happens is sentencing? At the end of the going through the whole Rule 11 business about the plea? And then he said, okay, now we'll set a date for your sentencing, but he didn't accept the plea?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, when was he going to decide about accepting the plea?
At the sentencing date, Your Honor. And in fact, if we accept that there's no such thing as a conditional plea, as petitioners submit, then there would really be no other way for a court to review an 11E1A agreement other than deferring the actual acceptance of the plea until he had the opportunity.
Did he say
it? But he didn't seem to do that. If he did it, but he didn't do it.
Did he say anything, or did we read this in black or white or red or some way? Did he say anything about not
specifically say I'm not accepting the plea? No, he did not, Your Honor.
He said he hadn't accepted the agreement.
Yes, he did. And nor did he say I accept the plea. And Your Honor, I submit that at the conclusion of a plea colloquy, it's nearly a mantra how the courts state, I find you've waived your rights knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. I'm entering a plea of guilty and making a finding of guilty. Let's set the matter for sentencing. And that was not done in this case.
Isn't what he did exactly consonant with Cordova-Perez?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, Your Honor, in Cordova-Perez, there was no question as to whether or not the court had accepted the plea. In Cordova-Perez, the court actually stated, I accept the plea. And it was really only a question of whether it was a conditional plea, conditioned on the plea agreement. In this case, it's even clearer that he did not accept the plea agreement, and we submit he did not accept the plea. So an even stronger case, we believe, than in Cordova-Perez. But
that's my point. If the trial judge were looking at Cordova-Perez, the trial judge would have believed he could do exactly what he did.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes.
So was the panel wrong, the earlier panel, in thinking that the plea had been accepted?
We believe so, yes, Your Honor.
What was the purpose of that whole proceeding where he went through the whole Rule 11 questioning of the defendant.
The purpose of that proceeding, Your Honor, was to make sure that the defendant intended to enter his guilty plea before entering a pre-sentence report and setting the matter for sentencing. And we submit that it is a rather unusual case that a court is going to reject a plea and or a plea agreement because the conduct is not adequately reflected in the seriousness of the charge. And so all the parties were proceeding on the assumption that the plea and the plea agreement would be accepted. And on this point, Your Honor, I don't know if Mr. Westinghouse, when he was cut off at the end of his time here, whether he was about to mention this, but in their pleadings to this Court, they had in the past agreed that the plea was not, in fact, accepted. Their position to the initial panel was that the Court didn't have the discretion to reject the plea and so that it should be treated as accepted, but it, in fact, was not accepted.
So is your reading then of 32E that says the time to disclose the PSR to the court until the defendant has pleaded guilty means just that he pleads, not that the plea has been accepted?
No, Your Honor. It is possible that in this case that rule was violated and that the pre-sentence report was ordered.
Why did he order the PSR if he thought that he hadn't accepted the plea?
Well, Your Honor, that issue, of course, has not been.
Do you think this judge violated Rule 32 to sort of, and in fact didn't intend to accept? So we should resolve the ambiguity on the theory that they can't violate Rule 32.
Your Honor, I believe the record does not reflect that the court accepted the plea.
I understand. He says okay, and then he goes through this other, including ordering the PSR. Doesn't ask if it's okay. He doesn't say it's a conditional plea. Do you mind if we go ahead and I look at the PSR before I make a final decision? The rule says it's not to be disclosed to the court until he's pleaded guilty. You said that means an accepted guilty plea. In that ambiguous situation, we're supposed to infer that Judge Tanner violated Rule 32.
Your Honor, I agree that if the court determines the plea was not accepted, then there was a violation of Rule 32. That is not what's complained of here. It's not been briefed, of course, and as far as the remedy.
It's ambiguous. You're saying we should find on this record and that the panel erred in doing so that Judge Tanner did, in fact, accept. And you're saying, well, we should assume that when he went ahead and ordered PSR, he did so knowing that he hadn't accepted the plea and therefore violated Rule 32. That's how we should construe the ambiguity, in other words.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe the court, in the later proceedings as well as the pleadings to this court,
Let's say we don't buy that.
Yes. If you don't buy that.
Does that destroy your case?
It does not, Your Honor, because of what we've spent most of the time here discussing, and that is the conditional plea agreement when a plea is pursuant to a plea agreement to a lesser charge. And that is precisely the case that United States versus Cordova Perez addressed. In that case, the defendant was charged with an offense. He pleaded guilty to a lesser offense. That plea was accepted. The court reviewed the pre-sentence report and determined this plea agreement is not in the public interest. It does not adequately reflect the seriousness of the offense.
But the whole concept underlying that case, which is that the two are inseparable, was exactly what the Supreme Court said we were wrong about in Hyde. So I understand that the exact issue was different, but the theory was the same, was it not?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the essence of the Cordova-Perez case was not that the plea and the plea agreement are the very same thing and that they cannot be separated. They did state that language, that the two are inextricably bound up.
Right.
Yes.
That's what they said.
They did say that, Your Honor. But they also recognized, because they spent a great deal of the opinion talking about, okay, we know the court accepted the plea, but did the court accept the plea agreement? So they did recognize that in some circumstances there can be a distinction.
Okay, well, there is a distinction here in that the 132 months is not binding. So that much, there certainly is a distinction. The distinction mattered here, but it doesn't go to undo the plea.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't.
But that doesn't mean that the plea disappears.
If you want to respond, you may do so briefly, but your time has expired.
Your Honor, the plea disappears because there was an agreement here under 11E1C as well as 11E1A, and it's the portion under 11E1A that would cause the plea to disappear when the plea agreement was rejected. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the case. The case is submitted for decision, and the court stands adjourned.